This is a case about a match made in hell, a serial killer couple nicknamed the San Francisco Witch Killers, Michael Bear Carson and his wife Susan.
God has spoken to Susan and told her that they need to go on a mission to kill witches, and that God has revealed who the witches are.
That's Jen Carson, daughter of Michael. For years, she and her mother were in hiding, afraid the witch killers were coming for them.
Meanwhile, they were sending her really scary letters. They were calling her. I mean, she was just convinced they were going to kill someone.
And she thinks there might be more victims out there.
And at their press conference, that they said they were arrested for one. They said they would confess to two more if they had a press conference. And they had a press conference. And as they're getting up to the microphone, Susan says to Michael, "Now, Michael, we're only talking about the ones in California."
Now, before we dive into the case, I want to remind you that this is for mature audiences and still might not be for everyone. After the episode, I have a shout out for investigators who wrote reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you. It's a way for you to be a part of the podcast, and reviews really help independent pods like this one get noticed. More on that after the case. The San Francisco Witch Killers. Investigators, you're on deadline.
From the social distancing studios in Las Vegas, Nevada, to your ear holes, this is True Crime Deadline, a podcast discussing cold cases, murder, mysteries, and completely random thoughts. Now your host, a man who sings happy birthday twice when washing his hands, Mr. Mystery himself, Matt Johnson.
Investigators, thank you for joining me for episode 35, Serial, The San Francisco Witch Killers, which happens to be the season finale for season 2. I know, I'm sad too, but don't worry, I'll keep you posted on the podcast, our investigations, and other true crime cases on my website, truecrimedeadline.com, social media channels under the same name, and my new YouTube channel. On YouTube, you can actually watch some of the podcast interviews like this one and see related pictures and videos, so please check that out and subscribe. And be sure to sign up for the Investigator newsletter, where you can learn about ways to support the podcast via Patreon, if you feel, and get free Investigator gear like my new stickers. Again, thanks for supporting the podcast. And with that note, some exciting news. True Crime Deadline won a big award. A 2020 People's Choice Award in the news and politics category. Thank you everyone who nominated and voted for the podcast. It's amazing because you know that this is a passion project for me. Storytelling really speaks to my heart. I love being able to feature lesser known cases and tell you what it was like to report on them from the yellow crime scene tape and talk to victims who share their stories with you in order to heal and help others, which is exactly what Jen Carson, daughter of one of the witch killers, is doing and you'll hear about. Now, when I started doing research for season 2, this case stuck out right away. I knew that the execution story was going to be the first episode, and the BTK's daughter was the second. And this case, I knew it was going to be the finale. It has everything you would expect: sex, crime, murder, living off the grid, and some of the most bizarre behavior you've ever heard of. It starts in the early 70s. A young couple, Michael Bear Carson, whose real name is James Clifford Carson, moved to Phoenix with his first wife. The young couple were hippies when they met in grad school, but one grew up and the two grew apart.
If someone wasn't familiar with the case, so this is happening in the 80s, this is happening in the San Francisco area. Walk me through the nuts and bolts of someone, if they weren't familiar with it.
Okay. So my mother, Lynn, was met my father in college. They graduated from the University of Iowa for undergrad, and then went to University of South Carolina for grad school. And they were training to be teachers. My father did student teaching as a fifth grade teacher. And then they later moved to the Phoenix area, where my mom had got a teaching job. And while they were there, my father's behavior and mental health just kind of started to really unravel. And they had met kind of in the counterculture war protest movement. And so the stuff that he used to say sitting around smoking a bong with all their hippie friends, like, you know, I can kill people with my mind, at the time was perceived to be, you know, bong talk, you know, at a party, you know. And so now that he's an adult with a child and he's married and he's talking about, you know, wanting to start a revolution and these things, I mean, now it seems bizarre, you know, because he's supposed to be a real adult, you know, and he's just really unraveling. The experimental drug use becomes more of an addiction. The, you know, his artistic moodiness as an adult now seems like a full-blown mental illness. So my mom does, he also started to become very violent. My mom does leave him, and he meets a woman named Susan, and he meets her at a party. It's his best friend's date, and they're at a party, and it's at her house, and she is this little rich girl who was a country club wife who starts to kind of leaves her husband for a bohemian life, to be this hippie. So, you know, free love, drugs, whatever. So she leaves him and she gets a huge divorce settlement, is in a posh townhouse in Scottsdale, Arizona. And my father goes to one of her wild parties and he never leaves. And when they met, it was like gasoline and a match. Mm-hmm. They were kind of instantaneously kind of addicted to each other. And my father always had one person in his life he was kind of addicted to. So it was, you know, initially it was his mommy, and then, you know, it would be a best friend. It would be high school girlfriend. It was my mom for a long time. It was when he was home with me as a stay-at-home dad while my mom worked, it was me. You know, he'd been a really hands-on dad, you know, baking cakes, brushing my hair, taking me to petting zoos, so on. And he was, you know, this sweet stay-at-home, you know, dad slash pot dealer, you know. And so I remember filling dime bags and, you know, his whole, you know, hippie lifestyle. But so we're now living separately. I'm visiting him on the weekends. And all of my early memories of him are really positive, except for the fights with my mom. And so on my first visit to this new place he's living, this townhouse in Scottsdale, he takes me there, and it's night, and he opens the door, and it looks like a dark forest in her house. And this was a memory I had for like decades. It was just recently confirmed by a detective in the case. Mm-hmm. She had painted her walls black and replaced, gotten rid of all the furniture and had potted trees all over the house, all inside the house. So I literally did walk into a dark forest when I entered her home.
Why did she do that?
She was just bizarre. She was diagnosed with mental illness as a kid and had been medicated for a number of years and was just unmedicated and on heavy drugs, was just absolutely bizarre.
And at some point you tried to escape. I read in an article.
Yeah. So, you know, and it's hard because these are really young, early memories. You know, so I had this memory of the forest and I didn't even talk about it for many years because I thought I was going crazy remembering these things. And that's when I found out this was actually true. And I have memories of sleeping on the floor in the forest, the only piece of furniture being a waterbed that they were laying on. They're passed out high naked. They don't feed me for several days. I'm crawling all over the kitchen to try to find food. I'm trying to escape the house.
That's terrible.
On a rotary phone to try to get help. And I'm asking the operator for mommy. And they're like, who's mommy? You know, so, you know, just really, really horrible memories the moment that she enters the picture. The last visit there, she severely physically abused me, and I came home with wounds. She had, I got home and I said my back hurt, and my mom looked at my back, and there were four distinct scratch marks from four or five finger digits, you know, and she ripped open my back. So my mom was like, we're done. These people are dangerous, you know? My mom went, called family members, the police. I mean, just anyone who would listen, saying these people are really getting quite dangerous. Meanwhile, they were sending her really scary letters. They were calling her. I mean, she was just convinced they were going to kill someone. And people blew off my mom as a crazy ex-wife, you know, or bitter ex-wife kind of thing. So they decide to sell the Scottsdale house and go on some religious journey, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, like some sort of like pilgrimage kind of thing. So they sell the townhouse. They decide to travel around the world. My mom hears that they attempted to get me a passport. So she's pretty sure they're going to take me on the next visit. And she heard this like hours before they were supposed to come pick me up. And so she drops me off at a random church where Catholic church where there were, I don't know if it was a full blown convent, but there were actual nuns who were living on site at this Catholic church. I want to say maybe it was a Catholic school. And she went and she said, I'm in danger. I need help. And she left me with some random nuns at a church.
Do you remember that? Do you remember?
I remember the staying with nuns for a couple of days as a kid. And I remember the nuns telling me, oh, you're such a good little girl that we picked you to come help us bake cookies. And I just remember like baking cookies and living with these like kind of magic. I've loved nuns my whole life, like mm-hmm. freakishly. Like I see them in the airport and I chat them up.
Maybe that's why.
That is absolutely why. I'm like always chatting up nuns. So
your little fairy godmothers.
They're my fairy godmothers. Yeah, I just remember baking cakes, staying with them.
Because who knows what would have happened to you if they had kidnapped you and took you overseas for this crazy journey.
Right, where we believe that they actually started killing people abroad.
Right.
Right. So that's where the killing is believed to happen. A couple of the cases were open Interpol cases at one point.
So they're overseas and uh-huh. you know, you put it as like a spiritual awakening or we don't know like that.
They start in the Middle East. He acquires the beginnings of citizenship in Israel. So they're initially going to live there and they're thrown out very quickly for drugs. So then they're off to Morocco and here and there, and then spend quite a period of time throughout Europe. And I've never been able to track down all the places they were. They were sending me postcards during this whole thing. So
what were
they
the postcards saying?
I have one about in India with an elephant, and the elephant talked to my father, you know, some sort of spiritual thing. And they would send postcards to our previous address, but then they started sending postcards to relatives that couldn't find us, whatever. So so they're on their journey. My mom packs us up and just vanishes. She leaves a teaching job with no notice, which you don't do, you know. So she leaves a teaching job. She packs up her car and we just kind of vanish.
After a few years in Europe, Michael and Susan make their way back to the U.S., and that's when the killing and suspicious deaths of coworkers and roommates began.
So I believe the murders start in probably 78 in Arizona or 79 in Europe. But the one we know of for sure is 1981. And it's so funny that they're known as the San Francisco Witch Killers because they were nomadic and they were staying there once a year for a month or so. And then mm-hmm. they blow through and then stay there again. So they're in Haight-Ashbury, which is kind of one of the places they would stop. And they had made friends with a young woman named Karen Barnes. And she was... really interesting girl. She had been an aspiring actress. She was in the movie Smoking the Bandit. She'd gone out to LA. She was Jane Fonda's housekeeper. And really, really beautiful girl. Strawberry blonde hair, stunning girl. She's living in Haight-Ashbury. She's an artist and she's doing a lot of performance art. Her closest friend, was the lead singer in a punk band, The Victims. And so she's living in Haight-Ashbury. And, you know, as they go along this path, my father is very interesting. He's very charming. And he kind of would make friends with these people along the path and they would stay with them. And they had made friends with Karen Barnes. And I think she liked hanging out with them the first few times she hung out with them. And then the next, you know, and this is what I keep hearing is that they, you know, they would meet this, you know, initially at the beginning, you know, in 79, 80, they were fun and interesting. And by 81, they're just scary, right, is what I keep hearing. So around 81, Karen is wearing rags. She would sew rags together to make this skirt. It was literally, I've seen a photo of it. It's crazy. She's wearing rags. They start looking crazy. They start sounding crazy. And she doesn't want them to stay with her. And what I think is she said, you can stay one night kind of thing. And that last night that they stayed there, they murdered her. They bludgeoned her with a frying pan and stabbed her in the neck. This beautiful, sweet girl, just loved by everyone. Just, you know, everyone who knew her said she was just unbelievably beautiful and unbelievably kind. And she was 23.
Is that what they were arrested for initially, for that murder?
So they vanish, and the next day, you know, the police are told by all of her friends, it was those crazy people, the Carsons. They did it. I know they had to have done it, you know. And all of her friends go to the police, and the police don't just kind of blow her off as a Haight-Ashbury hippie, you know, involved with the wrong people and doing the wrong thing, and just really don't do her enough justice. But also, the couple has vanished into the wind. They're gone. And they were really, really living off the radar. I mean, they would go in deep into the forest and stay for a month or two and never encounter another human. You know, we know that they were breaking into vacation homes in Northern California and staying, you know, in a garage of a vacation home, you know, or whatever. So the next we know of them, they're in 82, they're staying on the pot farm and in a large grow near Alder Point in Humboldt County. And they're working at this pot farm. And this young man is there named Clark Stevens. And Clark Stevens was kind of a same thing. All of these people were very kind of like bohemian kind of people. But he was a surfer from San Diego, and one of his high school friends had an enormous pot farm and had said, come up and work for a few months, I'll pay you a ton of money. So he was up there working on high school friend's pot farm, and he is just, you know, horrified by these two people's behavior. They're just acting so bizarre and everyone's face and spouting weird religious junk. And so what it sounds like is he was just like, you know, shut up, you know, right. I mean, just go over there and do your job. We don't need to hear your mumbo jumbo about. And their behavior, I guess, was bizarre. They would do these drills where they would escape in the night. And we now know it's because they had murdered someone, at least one person. And I think that the other murders, there weren't people tying them to it. And I think in this case, they knew that everyone around this woman would say it was them, you know? Mm-hmm. So some type of disagreement, you know, I assume he just probably asked them to calm down, you know? But next we know Jim shoots and kills Clark Stevens. They defile his body. They set him on fire, and it's really horrific. And they
your dad
vanish.
And Susan famous to this
they guy. set his body on fire. They get rid of his body again. They vanish, and everyone says it's the crazy people, the Carsons, right. But no one could find his body. He had vanished at this point, you know. Clark Stevens had also vanished.
Has his body been found since?
No. So what happened is some months later, there were some campers, and they were up in what was called Alder Point, which is now called Murder Mountain, and a dog kicks a skull and is playing with the skull. And it's horrific and it's awful. And that started the myth of Murder Mountain, was the horrific experience with the dog and beautiful Clark Stevens' remains. And again, Clark Stevens was physically very beautiful, very similar to Karen Barnes. It's interesting that they both had strawberry blonde, kind of red hair. They looked very similar, both beautiful young people. And so that actually started the myth of Murder Mountain. And when you hear people in Humboldt County talk about it, they actually don't tell the facts of the case. There's like this myth about that body. They also say that they buried many bodies up there, if you talk to people up in Humboldt. So they claim that there was more than one victim there.
Yeah, I've heard that legend before too. You know, when I was doing research on other true crime cases, that there was more than one body up there. That's fascinating.
It's tragic yeah, and horrible terrible. And all these things. So yeah, so they vanish again. So the next thing that happens is up in Northern California in the woods one day, there's a large search party looking for a hiker that's missing. And so, you know, it's probably park rangers, police, maybe some volunteers are on the search party looking for a missing hiker. And they're doing a grid search and, you know, whatever, looking for the missing hiker. And all of a sudden, out of thin air, jumps up these crazy looking people with long wild hair wearing rags, and they both scream and they start running in different directions. And one of them hits a tree like a cartoon character and is like, bong, like she runs into a tree. And then they see the man jump off a cliff. Like it wasn't very, but it was like literally pretty an area you probably shouldn't have jumped off, right?
Because they think that they're there for them.
Correct. So the two run in completely opposite directions. And one of the police there certainly weren't homicide detectives. It would have probably been a park ranger, you know, some law enforcement like that.
Right.
Picks up a backpack that was dropped by one of the crazies, and out falls a gun and bullets. And it just looked strange to him. It wasn't a hunting gun. It was a pistol. Mm-hmm. So he takes it back with him. And one of the items in the backpack is a typed, which looks like a school thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And on the cover, it says a cry for war. They had written a manifesto.
And so do we have any answers from this manifesto as to why they were killing people?
They had in the manifesto, there was a plan to kill Ronald Reagan, with notes showing that they had actually stopped Ronald Reagan. I do know they were in Washington, D.C. a couple times during that period. We have relatives there. And there were notes that they had actually stopped Reagan, like places he had been, they had been. There was a hit list of people they wanted to kill. One was Ronald Reagan, one was Johnny Carson, and one was Governor Jerry Brown. And David Rockefeller, there's a hit list. And then it all clearly, it's not very lucid. It's really kind of crazy to read, but it's all basically that God has spoken to Susan and told her that they need to go on a mission to kill witches, and that God has revealed who the witches are.
So what is the case that ends up leading to their arrest? Do they get arrested after they leave this backpack behind?
No, so the manuscript is turned into the police. The police then turn it into the Secret Service. The couple things, and there's also a bunch of fake IDs in there. Actually, pretty decent fake IDs are in there in the backpack. So Secret Service then started investigating the threats on the governor and the president. The Secret Service then shows up at our house.
And by now, did you have any contact with them? Like, did you know what was going on? You couldn't have.
No. We know now that they were in, that he was in and out of Southern California a couple times looking for me. So when they separate and go in different directions, I guess along their whole journey, you know, the drills they were supposedly running, like in the middle of the night, they would have this thing where they were supposed to meet up in Phoenix. When, if ever they get separated, they meet up in Phoenix. Remember, they have no cell phones. They have no landline phone. They have no address. So if separated, they're supposed to meet in Phoenix. Okay. Next, we know one of Clark Stevens' friends, because they're all from Southern California and they're a bunch of surfers, but they're all working on this pot farm up north and going back and forth. One of Clark Stevens is on the 5 freeway in Southern California and looks over and sees a hitchhiker and goes, oh my gosh, it's that crazy mother effer, Carson. And so he pulls off at the next exit, calls the police and said, I swear to God, I just saw the man that killed my friend. He's hitchhiking on the side of the road in Southern California. He killed my friend up in Humboldt. So police go to pick up this guy on the side of the road. He's wearing a black t-shirt that has the words on it, bizarre, bizarre, bizarre. Understatement. They go to pick him up. They bring him in and... very similar to the episode in the woods. They bring him in and they take his picture. They do his fingerprints. They do all the things. One of the detectives calls Humboldt, says, we have your suspect Carson here. The Humboldt detectives get in the car and start coming to LA. I mean, they're going to drive, what, 8 hours?
Wow.
They're in the car. So he's in the police station. There's another suspect in the police station and their paperwork gets mixed up.
How does that happen?
So Carson is sent to a rape lineup of a local rape victim. He's cleared and he starts, like he does a lot of times, he just charms people to death. And he starts, you know, making conversation with one of the police officers and they hit it off. And the officer's like, hey, buddy, let me give you a ride. And he gives them a ride back to the freeway. And so next thing you know, Michael Bear's in a car. He was hitchhiking and he's headed to Phoenix for the meetup. He's gone. He's in the wind.
That's incredible. They had him.
Police from Humboldt show up and are like, where's our killer? And they're like, oh, whoops. I think we accidentally let him go. But now they have, the only good thing about that is they now have his fingerprints, right? But I mean, how insane that they let him go. Now, after they let him go, the shift change happens. And the patrol officer who picked him up from the freeway goes out to clear out his gear out of the back seat. And they find a loaded gun in the back seat of the patrol car. He did a bad pat down. And Michael Bear Carson could have murdered him. So, I mean, that whole situation was such a shit show.
Part of the reason why Jen talks about the case is because she believes there are other victims out there.
Now, keep in mind, I keep mentioning these three horrific homicides in California, but they're not just in California during these 3 years. I mean, my understanding of their whole little circuit path was they would grow pot in a farm in Northern California. You know, then they would be going up through Oregon, up through Washington, you know, and then circling down to Arizona, New Mexico, you know, Oklahoma, Texas, Southern California. And they were just doing this circuit around the Western United States. And they're constantly in movement. They're constantly nomadic. And so the story sounds like it takes place in Northern California, but it doesn't really, you know. Mm-hmm. So next we know they're in Napa in 1983. And this man, John Hillier, gave them a ride. That's, you know, they were headed to Northern California. He offers them a ride and they ride with him one day. And I think, sleep in the back of his truck. And then, you know, he offered to give him a ride the next day. You know, so all he did was offer them the kindness of a ride. And next thing we know, in broad daylight in front of a strawberry stand, a big fruit stand, and along the freeway, families driving by with kids in their car, they're standing on the side of the road, and Susan is stabbing him with a knife, this man, John Hillier, and then my father shoots him. And this was, wow, in broad daylight with people, like, there was a teenager who walked out with a pallet of strawberries from the fruit stand and, like, walks out and sees this. And there were families that drove by and saw it. So just really horrific. They then take John's truck and they're pursued on a high-speed chase throughout Napa. They drive off the road, they get stuck in a creek, and then they run on foot. And when the police caught up with them, the first thing out of their mouths was Susan said, you know, something to the effect of, "Wasn't my driving badass? That was me. That wasn't my old man." She said, "I'm the good driver." It's just crazy. So they're taken into custody for the murder. They give an alias initially. They're soon connected to the murder of John Hillier and Humboldt. And they then write the San Francisco Chronicle, where the Zodiac Killer used to write, you know, to get attention.
Right.
They send a letter and they say, "How many people do we have to kill until we get front page," essentially. And they send this letter and they send a couple letters, and they're not getting the attention they want. And so next they say, we'll confess to one more murder if you give us a press conference. So this is the press conference in San Francisco that was 6 hours long. The few reporters that were there were like falling asleep, like literally laying across chairs like you would in the airport and going to sleep, like just keeping on the like turning on the recorder and then, right, like sleeping on the chairs.
What this did they have like to talk about? Hours. Was it their manifesto and they're going over all that stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen some of the footage. Not much of it, because the local station there, anyone who's wanted to watch it, they like are like, "If you pay us $500 a minute or something," I mean, some insane thing of this recording. But I've seen a couple minutes of it, and it's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. And it starts with the famous statement now, Michael, we're only talking about the ones in California.
How were you able to deal with the trial?
I should have immediately been thrown in counseling at that point, and I wasn't, you know. And my mom was, you know, so traumatized herself and so depressed herself, and, you know, so she tells me, but she doesn't really talk to me about it again. And no one is talking to me about it. And some months later, I come into contact with a bunch of newspaper clippings about the case. So I had known for a year that he killed people. And I that started a bunch of nightmares I had, where I would have nightmares of a woman crying and holding a picture of her dead kid. And I would try to hug the woman. I couldn't. So that was kind of the first set of nightmares that were happening. I then come in contact with a bunch of newspapers, and I'm reading, it was clippings my mom had in a drawer. I then come in contact with that they set the body on fire. They stabbed people. I remember sounding out a word I didn't know, and it was a B word. And I now know the word was bludgeoned. So then that starts the nightmares of like setting bodies on fire and stabbing people and beating people with frying pans. And so the actual details of the case are then in my head. The trials go on from the time I was 9 until I was, I think, 19. The trials and the appeals. And no one in the family is talking to me about it. As a teenager, I go to a university library and go through microfiche to try to get articles about the case.
And these are, you know, during your most formative years that you're right. experiencing all this trauma.
Right.
And then that leads to an attempted suicide, right? Eventually?
Yeah, no, that was immediately after I was told. It was either after I was told or I started to become suicidal after I was told, right? And then when I come in contact with how the murders occurred, you know, the bludgeoning, the stabbing, the setting on fire. That's when, so throughout that period of time, I'd say over a 2 or 3 year period, I was making different attempts. I was trying to take pills. I was trying to drown myself in the bathtub. You know, and I was actively suicidal during that period. Had an eating disorder as a teenager. Really struggled with severe depression, and I was in therapy for years, you know, just years and years, you know, unraveling, you know, kind of all of this.
And now you want to take that pain and that struggle and help others, right? Like, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And you know, I definitely, you know, it's interesting. I graduate from college and I become initially, I was working as a teacher. And I have this incident where I'm teaching, 8th grade history, social studies, and I'm sitting in front of the class and, I have a book open on my lap and I'm nodding off because I had had nightmares the night before.
Oh.
So it's 22. And I was like, enough, I'm done with this. And this is the 90s. And so I go after this pop culture concept of closure.
Mm-hmm.
So I decide the next day I'm going to drive up to Folsom Prison to see him as an adult. So my best friend from high school and I get in a car. We drive 9 hours. I get to Folsom and it looks like a dungeon. It's so creepy. It's one of the oldest prisons in the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is. You have to look at a picture. It is so creepy. And I go dressed like I'm going to a job interview. Because I didn't want to look like the daughter of a serial killer, whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like freakishly in like I think I was wearing a suit and heels. I mean, it was like just ridiculous. And so I wait in this long, long line for a really long time. And I get to the front and I show them the name and the prison number. And they say, oh, yeah, you're in the wrong line. And so they point over to the maximum security wing line. And mm-hmm. it's like 3 people. So I go and I had to go through so many security, you know, precautions. At one point, I'm in the bathroom taking a wire out of my bra because mm-hmm. you couldn't have wire. And so I'm, you know, going through all these checks and, you know, all these things. And then the last thing is I'm in this corridor where a door shuts like Star Trek. And I'm just in this corridor and I just get sick and I throw up. I run to the bathroom and throw up. I was so nervous.
That's a lot for anyone to handle.
A lot like, for anyone to handle.
I mean, yeah. You know, dad or no dad in prison, just being
going to see a serial killer at all is not, you know, it's not like mine. It's not like Mindhunter. There's no like nice coffee. You can't have a cigarette. Like, you know, it's just, it's not as fun. So I'm in the corridor and this like 6'6" huge guard is like, it's okay, sweetie. I mean, he was this like tough looking guy and he was so sweet. And I'm so ready for everything to be like Law and Order with the glass and the phone.
Right.
So I'm like ready for this. I have it in my head.
Were you face to face?
The door opens and I'm face to face. He comes up and hugs me. And I'm like, I had it in my head how this was going to go. And this is already not how it's going.
Right.
I'm unbelievably jarred that we're the same height. So I'm 6 feet tall in heels. He's 6 feet tall. And last time I saw him, I was you know, knee high to him, or, you know, whatever, you know, was, you know, and so I'm just really jarred. I'm jarred by how much we look alike. I mean, I'm just like, you know.
Because what? It's been 10 years maybe since you had seen him?
Longer. I think it'd been 15.
Okay.
I think it'd been 15. So.
So you're a little girl expecting to see the dad that you saw.
Right.
And this is all very strange. And this is not how it was going to go. And
yeah, this is not, there's no phone, there's no glass, I'm not in control, you know.
There's no protection, anything separating you from this person who you now know is crazy.
Right. So he's hugging me. I turn and this very attractive man is winking at me. And I recognize the very attractive man, and it's Eric Menendez. So this is really weird, right? This is super weird.
Wow.
Yeah, this is so effed up. Like, it's crazy. It's just bonkers. So a serial killer is hugging me, and then Eric Menendez is winking at me, and I'm just like, I'm in some sort of, like, you know, circus freak house or something. And so I start looking around the room, and it's like a wax museum of true crime. I'm like, weren't you the billionaire boys club murderer? Isn't that so-and-so? I'm like recognizing all these people. So we sit down and we're sitting there and we're face to face, and he just starts talking and talking and talking. He talks for like 3 hours. I barely speak. He very narcissistic, very much talking about himself. And I had gotten letters from him over the years, mm-hmm. always letters, you know, and he always he's like a broken record. He wants to talk about like the Kennedy assassination and Nietzsche. And, you know, he has certain topics he likes talking about, philosophy, history. He's very intellectual. So he's kind of like broken record of his greatest hits, you know, and then he randomly talks about the murders as if it was like self-defense, a bar fight kind of thing. Almost like I don't know any of the details, whereas I know all the details. I've read the court transcripts. So I'm just looking at him and I'm just like, you're really full of shit, you know, like that's not true. So he's just constantly spinning this kind of story of everything. And spinning kind of weird stories of like my mom and his divorce and things in the family that aren't true. And so it was interesting. Like he seemed to have some narrative that he would tell other people, you know? And this was kind of around the advent of, the internet. And I was realizing, I came to find out he had a lot of pen pals. He had some famous pen pals. And
like who?
One person he was talking to a lot was Jack Kerouac's wife. He was obsessed with Jack Kerouac and he was contacting his, it was very, you know, very strange. So he had, so I think pre-internet, he would reach out to people and he would essentially say like, oh, I'm just in prison for a bar fight, you know, or whatever, you know, and he had this kind of narrative that people were falling for, you know, and he could be very charming. And he never asked me anything about myself.
What was it that you wanted to tell him? And did you ever get to tell him that?
I wanted to say goodbye. I mean, I just kind of wanted to say goodbye. I know I kept thinking about, I wanted to see that he was a rat in a cage, that I was safe, other people were safe. I just needed to kind of see, and then I was going to just move on. I was going to say goodbye and I was going to move on. And a couple of things happened. I realized the sweet daddy I had known many years ago wasn't in there anymore. I don't know who was in there, but that guy wasn't there anymore. And he seemed kind of a pathetic character. I wanted to be angry in that moment. I wanted to show some rage and be like, you know, you monster, you've caused so much destruction, you know? And I wanted to just say goodbye and kind of move on. And he controlled the narrative, you know? But it was good because I got to see who he was. And I did in my own way get to say goodbye. It was kind of like, you know, whoever he was before the murders, he's not there anymore, you know? And, I'm going to move on and say goodbye.
Jen tells me she hasn't spoken to her father in years. And the last time she saw him in prison is still burned in her memory.
When I went to leave, he was like, oh, you're going to visit me now. You're going to write me now. And I was like, you know, so his letters before I went to visit him were very much like, I love you. I'm obsessed with you. You're the greatest thing. Then I leave and he then starts writing me with desperation, you know, come visit me again, call me, write me, whatever. And so that's where everything tips and he starts hating me.
Really?
Yeah.
And, you know, he probably liked the attention he got by having you there from people like Menendez and other people, you know, because yeah. It gives him another thing to talk about and be, you know, whatever. For so
yeah. No, definitely. And, you know, I'm...
because it's about him.
It's about him. And I hadn't thought about that. But, you know, I'm in my 40s. I'm a plus size woman. And when I was in my 20s, I had the figure of like Jane Mansfield. I was a really busty, thin girl. And now looking back, you never think you're attractive. But now looking back, I think I was quite pretty. And as a young woman. And so I think, you know, him, like you said, Menendez winking at me or whatever is like, now he has one more thing to brag about, like an attractive daughter, you know? So I can see that. Yeah, definitely.
So do you stay in contact with him?
I did not. No. I mean, that wasn't my intent. That wasn't my goal. And so I walked out and walked away. And 15 years after that, I go public. Mm-hmm. And then that changed the relationship again. He goes from hate to like blind rage, you know, and...
So are you afraid for your safety after that? Because, you know, how there's like all the crazy people that...
His fans
idolize,
and so on.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. fans, the, mm-hmm. the people that idolize mm-hmm. these people that are in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I start, you know, speaking publicly about my experience and my journey to becoming a behavioral health professional. And one point I'm going on a pretty high profile television show. And the producer, I didn't know, contacted him for a couple quotes. And he wrote back, you know, how could you let her ruin my good reputation?
His good reputation.
Yes, his good reputation. So, but he, there was a journalist he was obsessed with for a while, and he put the journalist book under his pillow and he was going to kill the guy with his mind. and so the prison, you know, warned this journalist. And so I'm pretty sure that that's where he's at with me right now.
Well, it's a good thing that I haven't written any books.
Yes. 'Cause you wouldn't want to be under his pillow.
I don't want anything to do with him. So he's still alive and he wants to get parole through the elderly parole program. And I've done a lot of speaking about that because of Manson and how mm-hmm. his followers mm-hmm. That are also in prison, they want to be released under that.
Yeah. So he had a parole hearing last month. But I don't know if he wants out or not. He wasn't really contributing with, he wouldn't talk to his lawyer. He wasn't participating. So, and he wrote, on a form he was given for his parole. He said, my views have not changed.
Well, there you go.
I still believe what I did was right. You know? So, and you know, I don't know.
The bar fight or killing witches.
Killing witches. I think the bar fight is gone, but you know, killing witches is now just because now he has fans. And so now he's, you know, gone back to that whole shtick. But he says his views have not changed. He's never felt guilt for killing these three beautiful, young, you know, innocent people, you know, who he claims that, you know, he was called to kill.
Now, have you ever spoken to the victims' families? Have you ever had a conversation?
Yeah, I have. I had an opportunity to meet with the three known victims' families, and collaborate with them on the first parole hearing. And so it was, especially, you know, meeting because of this repetitive nightmare I had had about this crying mother, it was really, life-changing for me to, you know, meet with one of the mothers, right. And say, I'm so sorry. You know, I mean, for so long I thought about the what ifs, you know, like that incident where he was brought in and misprocessed at the police station. Mm-hmm. You know, we know he at least killed one other person after that. I mean, it's just horrific. Or if anyone had believed my mother or, you know, whatever.
But you can't live like that. I mean,
yeah, no, absolutely. And I don't anymore, but I'm saying that around the time that I met, one of the victim's mothers, it was really, somehow a moment of releasing kind of some of those things, you know?
Mm-hmm. And did did she say anything to you?
She said, I didn't think you could even exist. She said, in my mind, they were monsters and monsters don't have children.
Yeah. And you're a lovely woman that wants to help others.
Yeah. I know one of the victims' families does get very angry that I speak out, that I'm so public. And I respect that. And I feel bad that, you know, it makes her, upset and uncomfortable. She's a wonderful, kind person, you know, as was her loved one. The other two, you know, I think we've been very united in stopping the parole, which I think is most important.
In 2015, Michael Carson refused a parole hearing because he said he would not denounce his beliefs that he says ordered him to kill witches. Currently, he's not eligible for parole until the year 2030. That's the same year Susan Carson will be eligible for parole next. As for Jen, she is not only focused on keeping her father behind bars, but helping others.
You know, I run a large suicide prevention program, and I work in behavioral health. And then I do a lot of mental health advocacy. And, there's no way to survive having a very violent parent who's, you know, infamous or, you know, so on. And so, you know, individuals who remain private, we know that, for example, Ted Bundy's daughter remains completely private, or Lee Harvey Oswald's kids or what have you. Some of these cases, people choose to remain private. And if that's what's working for them, that's great. You know, but I don't think that you should choose to live privately due to shame. I think it should be a decision that's what works best for you. And so I just try to promote that it's an option to just be transparent, you know, and that is what has worked for me.
And what's worked for you is take the power back, you know?
Right. There's not much people can say about me. And, you know, I was recently trolled really hard after an interview I did. It was one of the short internet videos, you know, you see them with, you know, these 5-minute clips or whatever. And so I did this segment, and, I had just been getting over an illness, and I just looked kind of horrible in the video. And,
oh no.
And I just, you know, I just look kind of awful, and I've done a lot of media or whatever, but I just, you know, looked really awful in this. And I'm a plus size woman, and, it's not usually a huge issue, but in this video, you know, most people wrote, oh, you're very inspirational. Thanks for all you do, talking about shame and whatever. And then this group of trolls just hits me so hard. And one of them says, boy, does she eat her feelings. And then someone then writes, no, it looks like she ate all of her father's victims. And then it gets worse. I mean, I got trolled hard. So, there's definitely some bad sides to, you know, choosing to be a public speaker when you're talking about your own life, and it's just par for the course.
Yeah. And someone that's dealing with depression, you know, that really, you know, it's a playground behavior, but you know, negativity impacts people. That's terrible.
Well, so I just want to mention that there, you know, I understand why people choose to be private, and it's a complicated choice. I mean, there's no manual, like, you know, how to survive a serial killer parent 101, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have people who tell me they relate to me, what, you know, when they have a parent, you know, who, you know, was complicated or negative or violent, or, you know, people have even dealt with a parent with domestic violence and so on. But so it's not roses, and, you know, it's not, I'm not saying go public, everything will be great, but it is what has worked for me. And there've been tough times, as I mentioned, the trolling. There's also this perception that, like, right now when I'm talking to you, that you paid me a lot of money. Like, there's this perception that I make a lot of money by being a public speaker.
In which, by the way, I haven't paid you anything. But
not a dime, right. So it's so weird that people think that, you know. And so I'm a nonprofit worker. I work in a suicide prevention program. I work for a nonprofit.
Yeah.
I live very modestly. So there's this, you know, I get trolled for my appearance. There's this misconception that I have made some sort of money off of this. And so there's stuff I deal with being public, but it's just really what's worked for me is being kind of open and transparent.
Well, keep being you, keep staying positive. And it's amazing that you've been able to take that apple that fell from the tree, and you're helping so many people and making the world a better place, unlike your dad.
Yeah. And you know what? I want to say right now, if you were the product of a rape, you were born from incest, you have a parent who's a domestic abuser, a rapist, you know, child abuser, you know, we all can break cycles. We can all choose to live completely different than our parent lived, you know? So, you know, just take back that choice, take back your power, you know?
Absolutely. Well, you're a lovely woman, and thank you. Keep fighting for the good fight.
Absolutely.
Investigators, thank you for a great season 2 of the podcast. Be safe, be good to one another. We're in this together. And my French bulldog, Mr. Gatsby, and I will see you next season. Until next time.
Thank you for investigating True Crime Deadline with Matt Johnson. For more information about the podcast, visit truecrimedeadline.com. And remember, all tips regarding a case should go to the police. Until next time.
Mr. Gatsby, want a cookie? Good boy.
Now, a post-episode shout-out to investigators who wrote reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you. Again, writing reviews really helps independent podcasts like this one get noticed. We're up against those networks, studios, TV channels, so you name it. It's easy, free, hit 5 stars, subscribe, tell a friend, write a review, and include your real name and your podcast name if you're a podcaster. You'll get a double shout out. So the first one comes from Jessica, who writes, "Interesting podcast. Your distances from Springfield, Missouri are way off in episode 33. So, outside of that, the content is interesting and well-delivered." Well, I say take it up with Google Maps. That's how I got the distance. But again, thank you for listening. Thanks for the input and writing the review. And see, that's proof that I do read them. The second one comes from Nikki T., who writes, "Fantastic podcast. I highly recommend this podcast to anyone who is a true crime podcast listener. The quality and production is great. Matt is an outstanding host that keeps you coming back for more. We can tell that the research is carefully done, even Google Maps." Just kidding, she didn't write that. "I love the show. It's perfect to binge. And anyone who is new to the podcast," this is me speaking now, "thank you, and please continue to binge and tell your friends, because it'll be a few months before we have new episodes." Investigators, thank you, and until next time.